From the sea emerges a beast. From the sea, isn't that where chaos is? Isn't that where the demonic is? Isn't that where the devils go when Jesus chases the devils out of the Gadarene demoniac? They go into the water, into the sea. That's where devils belong, in their mythology. Any sailors among you will know that they're actually mostly on land. But we've got different ways of looking at it. We're talking about symbolism here, not geography. So I saw a beast, and we better find out what this beast is, because this is the way evil actually occurs in this struggle. Not in the heaven with Michael, whatever, this is us. A beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads. Do you remember anyone else who looked like that? The dragon, we've just done it. So this is an incarnation of evil. 10 horns, apparently universal power, but limited. 7 heads and 10 royal crowns upon its horns, and a blasphemous name upon its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's. Its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it, the dragon gave his power and his throne and his exercise of power, his practical energy. One of the heads, there are 7 of them, fullness of them, one of the heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And the whole earth followed the beast with wonder. People worshipped the dragon, for he had given his exercise of power to this beast from the sea. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast?" Does that remind you of anything? Who is like God? Michael, Michael. This is a play on Michael. This is the opposite. Who is like the beast? The fascination here is with the beast. The worship is of the beast, not of God. And who can fight against it? To jump ahead a few chapters in this little detective story, the beast from the sea is undoubtedly the Roman Empire of the day. He's not talking about Rome today. He's not talking about... And we're not going to find this beast... We might find the equivalent in our day. Right, let's find it. In our life, in our community, in whatever, and there'll be many equivalents to it. But the beast he's talking about is undoubtedly the maritime power of the Roman Empire, which has come out of the sea into Anatolia or Asia Minor, and which has the blasphemous name of Caesar. Who is like Caesar? And the worship is being given to the Roman Empire, and up in Pergamum, where they've got this beautiful temple to Roma and Augustus, the Christians are being asked to worship Caesar. It's obvious enough, and it'll become obvious as we go on. I'm just giving you a little hint ahead of time. The wound that was there healed, I won't say now undoubtedly, but absolutely very probably, there was a legend, is that the word, or folklore might be a better word for it, at the time, independent of Christians, that Nero was just about the pits as far as the emperors are concerned. And 7, you don't have to name the 7. 7 is obviously all the Roman emperors, okay? The fullness of them. And so on. So one of them was Nero, whom they knew, of course. Nero was the one who started the persecution of the church and was responsible for the murder of Paul and Peter. So it's quite significant. There was a folklore around that Nero had been reincarnated in Domitian. One of the heads was wounded, Nero, but it had healed. Domitian is Nero redivivus. Do you remember, this is funny to us, we don't hardly think like this, but do you remember Herod, when Jesus was there, and they said, "Who is he?" And he said, "Some say he's John the Baptist come back to life." So this business of who's who and what's what and where people are and people coming back and reincarnation of souls and all the rest of it was all part of their, as it still is, in some senses, not so much with us presumably, but with some people. So this is the thought that, this terrible emperor who's now persecuting the whole church was Nero come back again, because he was like him in his manner and whatever else. So the allusion, which they would have been very clear about, most probably, as far as the scholars are concerned, is to that. And we're going to see it comes back two or three times for the rest of our story. The language of our passage comes from, it's not new, this language that we've got there in the Apocalypse. It's found in other apocalyptic literature, and in fact it comes from the description of the empires which subjugated Judah, found in the book again of Daniel, who's quoted hundreds of times in our text. And it reached its climax in Antiochus Epiphanes IV in the book of Daniel. Antiochus Epiphanes IV was the one who went into the temple, the desolation of desolations, who put the statue of Baal Shamem, the Baal of the heavens, or Zeus actually, but in its local variety, in the very Holy of Holies. And the Maccabean revolt was against Antiochus Epiphanes IV and the Syrian army that was trying to Greekize or Hellenize Jerusalem. Well, in that book of Daniel, which is about that persecution, that 3.5 year persecution, we read, four great beasts emerged from the sea, the first like a lion, the second like a bear, another like a leopard. Can you see all the images there? And I saw another had 10 horns. It's not identical, but it's using the same imagery. 10 horns, we've got 10 horns here. I saw another horn sprouting. 10 horns and this other one sprouting, with a mouth uttering haughty words, making war on the saints and proving the stronger. That's Antiochus Epiphanes in Daniel chapter 7. In the Apocalypse, he makes the equivalent. It's Domitian, the Roman emperor. The king will do as he pleases, says Daniel 11:36, growing more and more arrogant, considering himself greater than all the gods. He will utter incredible blasphemies against the God of gods. He will thrive until the anger, God's anger, reaches bursting point. And our text continues, and the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words and was allowed to exercise power for, do I have to tell you, 42 months, 3.5 years, 102,000. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, the blasphemies of the Roman occupying army, which had all the military power, all the commercial power, all the economic power, and told Christians to buckle under or go under. Worship Caesar, belong to the state, join the Roman army, become part of this seductive, cruel, dominant power, or we'll wipe you out. It's obvious. I'm not going to have any of this Jesus and this Christian and whatever rubbish. The gods are all in the Roman thing, and we're not having any of this. Blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And effective power was given to it over every tribe and people and tongue and nation, the Roman Empire everywhere. And all who dwell on the earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. Everyone's supposed to worship it. And it ends with the same words that came in the letters back in chapter 2 and 3. The one who has ears, hear. Symbolic. You ought to know, says John, who I'm talking about. Maybe, it's not unlikely, that this particular letter of the Apocalypse, if it's going to get through and get preached in the churches, it might have to be a bit careful. If you're in Hitler's Germany in 1941... you might talk like this, and everybody might know what you mean, but the stupid old SS haven't got the brains to see that you're actually talking against Hitler. Couldn't it be like that? Couldn't the code be a purpose of protection as well as anything else? At any rate, the one who is to be taken into captivity, go into captivity. Life will go on. The one who slays with the sword must be slain. Text from ancient scripture and from the New Testament. Here comes the absolute central theme of the whole of the Apocalypse. This is what the whole book's about. Herein is the endurance and faithfulness of the saints. That passage will come back again soon. Herein is the endurance and faithfulness of the saints. If they cast you into captivity, go. Bonhoeffer, if they throw you into prison, go. Jesus, if they crucify you, go. But don't give up on your faith. Don't worship Caesar. Don't buy the values of the system. Don't just get so sucked into this. Don't drink in the water that's being offered you that promises you eternal life or whatever. Hold by the values of Christ. The love, the patience, the gentleness, and the rest of it. It's a matter of endurance. It is a battle, says John to the community. He doesn't describe it in detail because he doesn't know what it'll be. It'll depend on the free decisions that people make. But it is a battle that we're engaged in. Endurance is important and faithfulness is important. Listening to the word, acting accordingly, and letting people put trust in you, because they will recognize we have a mission to do to this vast empire, to draw people from that value system into a whole new value system. Now, it becomes more precise. I saw another beast. Okay, we've got the Roman Empire, the maritime power, which incarnates evil, as our author sees it. We're not saying it was totally evil, of course. But from his point of view, which he's going to make more explicit later, it is basically evil. I saw another beast which rose out of the earth, this one. It had two horns, like a lamb. Like a lamb. Interesting. It spoke, however, like a dragon. This beast is going to become absolutely obvious later. You check it. I'm not trying to hoodwink you, but you'll find in the text it becomes obvious later. He's talking about false prophecy. He's talking about some local in the land, presence, probably within the Christian community, that is saying, as we'll see in a moment and later, yeah, let's buy into this Roman thing. Let's accommodate to it. What's the good of getting persecuted? What's the good of losing our leaders? What's the good of, you know, being so different? The only way to get on top is to get into it and gradually work our way up. Do God's work, but you can only do God's work from the top, forgetting that you've been corroded as you go in, you know. Let's be part of this system and then convert it from within. What a good idea. Get your $1 million and then you can give little peanuts out to the poor. So, work at it. And when you're 84 and you've just made your million, you die. You haven't got the chance to give the first peanut out. But work at it, kind of thing. So, this is like a lamb. It appears to be Christian. It appears to be like Christ. It appears to be okay, but it's not. It's deceptive. The words that are coming out of it are the words of the beast, the dragon. It exercised all the power of the first beast in its presence. Yes, Caesar. No, Caesar. Certainly, Caesar. We'd be very happy to accommodate you, Caesar. Yes. Of course, the church has a different point of view, you realize, Your Excellency. But, of course, yes, let us, yes. What's a few Jews, after all? Yes, certainly. Go ahead. Thank you, Your Worship, Archbishop. That'll be lovely. See you later. And we don't want any persecution of the Christians, do we? Oh, no, no, Your Excellency. No, my Lord, no. Thank you, Your Excellency. God bless you. God bless you, my son. Go. It had all the to make the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. Domitian's not such a bad bloke, really. His mother was actually a daily communicant. It works great signs, miracles, all these things that you're very aware of that can be beautiful but may not be and need to be checked all the time by love. By wisdom and by humility and by the Beatitudes. Or you see charismatic groups, you see Pentecostal groups going right out of touch with Christ and still working miracles. So one has to be. It works great signs. It even makes fire come down from heaven to the earth in the sight of the people. And by the signs which it gives to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image for the beast which was wounded by the sword and yet revived. And it was given to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast should itself speak. There's local little temples and local this and whatever. You know, BW or BM, you know. And to cause those who would not worship the beast to be slain. Responsible for persecution in some sense. And it causes all to be marked on the right hand or the forehead. They're being marked. Remember the Christians that were marked with a seal? These are going to be marked too, like slaves, because they're slaves, both free, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, marked on the right hand or the forehead so that no one will buy or sell unless he has the mark. You must have a Visa card to get in. That is the name of the beast, or the number of the name. This calls for wisdom, he says. Let the one who has understand and reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. The number is 666. Wacko, we're getting straight into this. Quickly, there are millions of suggestions that have been made all through history as to the meaning of this. I've sorted through 250,784 of them, okay, or something. Only three of them make sense to me, so I offer them to you. The first is this. 666, every number has an equivalent. In every letter has an equivalent number. Some, and it has been suggested for many years, that it could stand for Nero Caesar. N50R200, that's all up there for you to see. But if you add the letters of consonants of Nero Caesar, you end up with 666. It may simply be referring to the number of the beast, to Nero Caesar, which is Domitian, which isn't saying no more than I've already said to you. A second possibility that's been suggested is that it might be an allusion to the divine number, 9, that I've already mentioned to you, 9, 18, 27, remember that on one day? Truth, Emmet is, look at it, Emmet is adds up to 441, 4 plus 4 plus 1 equals 9. 6 plus 6 plus 6 is 18, 1 and 8 is 9. Is he saying that the number of this beast, like the mark of Cain, has been put on it by God? In other words, don't worry about it. The number it has, it's under God. I mean, God isn't going to be frightened by this, all this going on. It's subject to the overall providence of God and so not to be feared. Is that what's being said? Or, the one I like most of all, Irenaeus was born a generation after our time. He was born in, or he lived in about the middle of the 2nd century. Irenaeus was born in Asia Minor. He was brought up by Polycarp, who was a disciple of John. He was very close. He knew the language. He knew all the people. And in his book, Adversus Heresies, he warns people, even in his time, in the middle of the 2nd century, to stop all this wild guessing. And he suggests that 6 is half 12, the zodiac, 1 short of 7, isn't it? 6. 666 is 3-told imperfection. It symbolizes, the suggestion is, anything that's godless, anything that's evil for all time, anything that falls short of the mystery, any full, as full as you can get of imperfection is 6. Double it or triple it 3 times, and you've got total failure to reach the transcendent, which is 7, which is perfect, which is divine, which is God. 666 is a, from every way you look at it, total failure to reach beyond what is apparent into the mystery of the transcendent. Each generation, in other words, has to find out, and they had to find out, who it meant for them. Probably for them it meant Domitian, Roman Empire, all that's been said. There's no great mystery in this. And probably for us, we have to find our Achilles heel, our area of failure, and so on. Pastor Cozzi.